From the Witherspoon Concert Hall in Omaha's Joslyn Memorial, KIOS-FM proudly presents another program from the Uta Holly Lecture Series. We'll hear a talk given by Emma McLaughlin and Nicola Krause, co-authors of The Nanny Diaries. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Monday morning, May 10, 2004, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the Uta Holly Girls Village, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Uta Holly Lecture Series Board Chairman Jody Hobson.
You know, in our world today, we hear and we read and we see so much that is negative and fearful that it is really good for us to come and have fun today with the nannies. Our speakers will bring to you a comic account of a serious subject. Their first book, The Nanny Diaries, was on the New York bestseller list for many, many months. It caught the country's attention, and they were asked to appear on all the networks, The Today Show, Entertainment Tonight, and The View are some of the programs that they were on. And they also were covered in all the major newspapers and magazines. Foreign rights of The Nanny Diaries have also been sold in 29 countries, as well as the film rights by Miramax. They surely strike a chord with all of us with their experiences in the workplace. Both are graduates of the New York University Gallatin of Individualized Study, and they concentrated on art and education while in college. In November, they have a new book, Citizen Girl, and it will be out in the bookstores, I think, as November 23rd. So now, won't you give a warm Omaha welcome to Emma McLaughlin and Nicola Krause, the nannies.
Thank you so much for that lovely introduction. And thank you so much to Jody and to Sarah Young and to everyone who made our presence here today possible. We know a tremendous amount of work and organization went into every detail of our stay, which has been absolutely delightful thus far. And we hope that the next hour will be delightful for you.
We're going to, one mic, we're going to sort of,
we'll be close.
A little dancing up here. We've been asked to do many fundraisers and different kinds of events as a result of our success with the Nanny Diaries. And I have to say, this really is one that touches closest to our hearts. We did both go to NYU, and we both studied arts and education. And Nikki was working with younger children, and I was working with adolescent girls and boys, looking at how to use the theater arts to help young people find their voice, find their sense of self, find their way in the world. And that's that infusion of those elements is just something we think is very vital to navigating out there. So we feel that sense of resonance with Uta Holly, and we're thankful for that connection. And also, we feel that the Nanny Diaries, for us, was, which we're going to talk much more about, but in short, was very much a study of a family and looking at the role of a, how do you come in as an outside person and really enable a family to care for themselves, and how in a particular part of our culture, that child care provider, which is one of the people who comes into a family, frequently things can be thrown really out of balance, as happens in the ex family when nanny comes in. So we ourselves have done a lot of thinking about, you know, and from our own experiences being that external person, how do you really help a family to love and care for each other? It's a really hard and incredibly rewarding road to navigate. So we just wanted to speak to you a little bit about where we see ourselves with Uta Holly, and which I have this like mental block about mispronouncing. With our background in theater, I keep thinking of
Uta Hagen.
Uta Hagen. Uta Hagen. And it's not Uta, it's Uta, right? So you'll bear with us. And you know when you, well, perhaps we're only bizarre in this way, but the minute you are corrected on any pronunciation, you get this sort of whenever you're about to say the word. So I'm going to have a moment of pause before I say Utah, Holly. But regardless of its title, its mission in the world is very close to our heart and our values. So we're very thrilled to have been called upon to speak with you in its conjunction.
We thought we'd talk with you a little bit about how the Nanny Diaries came to be. Emma and I met when we were seniors at New York University, and we were taking a class on gender in performance, which was, I think, one of the sillier things that I studied while at NYU, and Emma and I became fast friends, mostly because, in addition to finding the class somewhat giggly, we were both juggling working as childcare providers with our studies. And we understood the moments where you're like, should I just put the kid in my backpack because the mother hadn't come home? So we had a lot to bond about. However, contrary to popular belief, because we are 30, we graduated. We went on to do other things. Emma was doing organizational development, and which is sort of like nannying a corporation. And about 5 years later, we were starting to look at how, as the economy was really spiking in the late 90s, there were a lot of articles in New York City publications about how hard it is to find good help. And yet the domestic workers were never interviewed, which is unusual for places like the New York Times and New York magazines. They usually strive to show both sides of a story. And yet when it came to domestic work, they didn't seem to feel any obligation, or the nannies did not feel safe talking. So this imbalance was something that was really striking Emma and myself over the course of several months as the articles were getting more and more egregious and the women being interviewed were revealing a deeper and deeper sense of entitlement. And finally, it sort of spiked in a moment in which Emma said, you know what? Someone's got to tell the other side of what it is to do this job. And we were feeling a sense of identification not only with domestic workers but with teachers and mothers and everyone, I think, in America who works with children. We are underpaid and undervalued, and we feel that our contribution is so vital because without, you know, nurturing these children, how do we have a strong next generation? So that was our impetus for getting together and starting to look at these issues. And Emma's going to talk a little bit about how our studies in Gallatin sort of played a part in the way we started to envision the book.
The world is such a small place, I have to say, because in our short time here, which is not even yet 24 hours, we have spoken with a handful of you whose children were not only NYU students, but Gallatin School of Individualized Study students. So, you know.
Go Gallatin.
Yes, Nebraska, New York. Good, tight connection there. So we were very fortunate. The Gallatin School is a wonderful, wonderful program, and it's a great books program. So not only that, your basis is sort of the canon of literature, and from that you get to be very independent and going off and studying in all the other programs at New York University, as well as doing external internships, and then pretty much anything you can put together, as long as you weave it all together with this wonderful foundation of the canon. And we were really interested by the fact that we were studying and reading many classic texts which featured nannies, or nurses, really was the title back in days of yore, and that dating really back to biblical times, there was a character who would sort of enter onto the set or stage, even within Shakespeare. You'll think of Romeo and Juliet, the nursemaid, who sort of stumbles on and has one or two lines to the effect of, something's terribly amiss here. So being nannies at the time, we had a heightened awareness of the presence of these characters. And it really was interesting that clearly kind of bubbling beneath the literary consciousness, there was a voice here that had not spoken. And it was really interesting. And we had kind of put that aside. And as we were finishing writing Nanny Diaries, we kept saying, we'd love to reference that we're hardly the first people to explore this character. And we spent a couple of days going back into our studies from, at that point, quite a few years ago, and looking through all these texts that we had read and having such fun. And those are, in fact, the quotes that head each chapter, discovering these really weighted lines. And then, most enchantingly, really rediscovering Mary Poppins. Is it P.L. Travers?
Yes.
Yes. Which is a gorgeous book. And a gorgeous character, and I think many of us think of the Walt Disney version, but in fact, the book itself is pretty much the Nanny Diaries. And thank God we had written it by the time we read it again, because we would have really been given up completely. But Nanny, or Mary Poppins rather, it's a very, very much a satirical look at this, the role that was played during that time of the childcare provider, which quite sadly, in many parts of society, including Park Avenue, has not changed much. Explanation for many things that she was able to pull off in these incredibly challenging circumstances with a very difficult family was magic. You know, this was a woman who solved things by flying and having a bag of sugar that was, you know, clean the room by having the kids dance around on the ceiling. And all of you who are mothers and fathers know that, well, of course, if, you know, you could fly and coke kids up on candy that didn't have them crash afterwards and other drugs, et cetera, that, you know, it would all work. So it was really wonderful to go back and see that. And I highly recommend, not only is it a satire, it's an utterly enchanting story. And the other book that was the most resonant for us, that was one of the more current books, was the Peter Pan, the novel of Peter Pan, again, which Disney has completely embedded into our memories as the primary representation. But in fact, the novel and the character of Nana, the dog, again, sort of a, what's the magical solution for parenting? Having a dog who can understand your children, bathe your children, put your children to bed, let you know when your children need anything. And in that book, it's quite wonderful and disturbing and emotional to follow the author's undoing of the family as the kids don't come home, and the terrible guilt that Papa, what is mm-hmm. this, feels in having put Nana outside when she was trying to tell them at the beginning that the kids were going to be taken, that there was danger in the air. And there's a quote we use in the book, but to repent as his children never come home, you know, don't come home for on and on and on, and to make up for the sin of ignoring Nana and punishing her, in fact, he gets into a doghouse and then wears a doghouse to work, home from work, and around. Again, this sort of heightened literary conceit that, looking at these family dynamics, the idea, and it was tempting to put Mr. X into a doghouse, have Mr. X, you know, ride in his town car down to Wall Street and out to the club in a doghouse was really, it was compelling. We had to fight that. So just to share with you that we've been extremely blessed to have such success and such attention given to this novel, but we actually come from a long literary tradition. And I think the fact that, as a culture, as Nikki said, childcare is so undervalued that it probably, the books that speak to them as well have been kind of pushed to the side. But we recommend, if you're looking for a sweet read for yourself and an incredibly well-written, both the original Peter Pan and Mary Poppins make for great vacation reading.
When Emma and I wrote the book, we hoped our families would read it and our friends. We had absolutely no sense of how well it was going to be received globally. The first day that it was available in bookstores, Emma and I went to a Barnes & Noble in Midtown, and we said, "Do you have the Nanny Diaries?" And he's like, "Oh, I think we have a couple of copies left." "How many have you sold?" He said, 44. And Emma and I are counting out our friends, our family. We're like, some of those people have to be strangers. And we couldn't believe it. But as the story of the Nanny Diaries started to grow in the media, there was a sort of this strange myth started to be promulgated that this was a story of a family Emma and I had worked for, which was in fact not the case. Emma and I had worked for many families. We'd had a myriad of experiences, you know, from the sublime to the ridiculous. But this novel was crafted with every single choice was an idea that had come from our imagination to make a novel work. I mean, real life is typically pretty boring. So to make it a novel with a plot and a family that was interesting and intricate and hooked, we had to create them. But there was this idea that we've been running around somewhere with a tape recorder. So we had hoped, with our background in arts and education, and especially with Emma's background in organizational development, we had hoped if anything would come out of this book, it would be the idea of people starting to create some sort of system, some sort of resource for families. Because there's no, like, how to employ a nanny for dummies, or, you know, how to have a child care provider for dummies. We can send teams out into space. You know, we know how to put a bunch of people now in the outback or the Amazon and have them work together to build a tribe and a hut. We know systems. We know how to get people to work together. And yet there's very little resources available to families on how to bring someone into your home and have that work to the best benefit of you, the child care provider, and most importantly, the child. And yet we were surprised that the general response seemed to be, let's get non-disclosures. Let's just shut everyone up. That's the solution. Let's just keep it all being really dysfunctional, but not talk about it. So it was very surprising to us that instead of a sort of a whole movement saying, let's look at this, let's look at how we can create a working contract or more open communication, we create a very satirical look at the interview in the beginning of the novel, because we were, I think, consistently surprised as employees, and there have been several articles in the New York Times in the last couple of weeks reiterating this, that our references weren't checked. You know, we were nice people. We did actually work with children in school. We really knew our stuff, but we also could just as easily not have. And we were just surprised that there wasn't more of a system in place for how to go about saying, you know, I really can only work Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, and that would be heard and repeated back to you, and that a mother could say, you know, I really will never be home before 7, and then, you know, that just the way it would be in any job interview, in any other arena. And, you know, and it's a completely subjective generalization on my part, but the working women that I worked for, and this is totally unscientific and could be a total coincidence, but they understood the kind of behavior they expected from their employers, and they brought that home with them. You know, they knew that I needed to be paid every Friday, not just the occasional Friday, or when the mood moved them. And they understood that if we had an agreement that they would be home by a certain time and they were running late, they would call, because if they were running late in the morning, they would call their employer. And it was a wonderful system. So if we can somehow bring the systems that are in place and work so effectively in corporate America into the domestic sphere, we think that that would be at least the beginning of sort of a productive dialogue, as opposed to a non-disclosure, which we don't think really would accomplish anything.
And that being said, it's important to point out that Mrs. X, the nanny's employer, is neither a working mother nor is she a stay-at-home mother. She's sort of in a category unto herself. We never quite established, nor did Nanny, what it is that Mrs. X does with her time, and had quite a lot of fun letting Nanny explore all the possibilities and her imagination of what it is that Mrs. X is actually doing. That is so important. But in the environment in which we worked, in that strata of Park Avenue, and of society, I think, at that level of wealth, frequently it has become the trend that if you are, it's rare to have, especially in New York, and really, unfortunately, we can only speak to New York, although we have heard from childcare providers or nannies not only across the U.S., but from many countries in which this book has come out, that stay-at-home mothers at that level, the norm is that you really don't spend very much of your stay-at-home time with your child. It feels a little bizarre. It felt a little bizarre to us. So just to share with you that, so then when you had a working mother in that community, it did tend to be feel more normal, at least to our childhoods, because our mothers had at different times worked and at different times stayed at home. But staying at home with us usually, unfortunately for them, meant staying with us. So it was a new experience for us, as it was a new experience for Nanny to come across a community where the cultural norm was for the most part for the women to not work and also not parent
or clean or cook right, or shop or iron.
Yeah, to just nothing really. It was a norm of doing nothing. And it's strange. And as Nanny observes with Mrs. X, doesn't. Also, just from a being female perspective, didn't necessarily lead to a sense of well-being or peace or happiness. There wasn't a glow of joy about Mrs. X. And it's interesting because I think for all of us, you know, even us, the idea of just having it all, having the kids, you know, having the money flowing in and not necessarily having to do anything. You know, it's got a nice ring to it. Could it be so bad? I mean, right? All of us, we could be kind of happy doing that, right? And loving and loved. We purposely chose a young woman at 21 for many reasons to bump up against Mrs. X, who is where she is in her life. And one of them was, at 21, it's your, you know, frequently it's your first job. You know, you've probably worked at different levels, but this is really the point in your life where you're about to graduate, you're looking at who am I going to be professionally, which now in 2004 is for young women very closely linked to who am I going to be, and have her enter this job when that point, and I think a lot of us can remember, for us is still very strong and stays with us, especially for women, for a very long time, where you expect, you kind of displace your mother or father or both with your employer. They kind of cross into themselves. And we wanted to have two characters who were really desperately seeking validation, as we felt Nanny, you know, at that age, just desperately wanting to please, that for Nanny, not counting any amount of income or anything, the idea of Mrs. X turning around to her and saying, "Thank you. You have done a spectacular job with my son. I find you invaluable. You're going to go far in the world. It's all going to be okay from here." You know, that, which, of course, the first part of it we can kind of aim for, but the second part of it, you just don't get that from a boss. And I think that, you know, you can probably get that from a mom or dad, but it's a very hard moment in life to come up against that. And then place her across from a character, Mrs. X, who's completely displaced her need from validation, which she's seeking from her husband, who's absented himself from the family, from the city, from the country, from his life, to put that entirely into this 21-year-old girl, who, of course, can't possibly give you the what you're looking for from a spouse and rightfully are entitled to from a spouse. So dramatically, the idea for us of putting these two characters essentially in a few rooms and an elevator together for 200-some-odd pages seemed like a really interesting exploration.
We also then decided that we needed to have some characters in the novel who were going to be foils for the exes. And those turned into Grandma and HH. And some people have asked us, especially Miramax, as they started to work on the film, you know, that they found the character of Grandma problematic, which our grandmothers found insulting, because they thought, well, you know, if Nan has access to money, then why is she doing this job? And we never saw it that way at all. I think we both come from families in which the work ethic was instilled in us at a very young age and very hard. And New York City being what it is, college tuition being what it is, we're all out there working. But we really wanted the character of Grandma to show that there are people in New York City and people around the world who have a certain amount of affluence and are full of joy and love, and they're using their money to enrich the world, to do charitable acts, to make other people happy. And that it doesn't have to be this curse. It doesn't have to lead to the kind of icebox environment the exes live in. So it was Grandma's joie de vivre that we felt was very important. And the other character is HH. We needed to show, it was so funny because so many journalists assumed that one of us had actually dated someone who lived in a building we had worked in, which neither of us ever did. HH was
a fabulous idea. And I tell you, we'd probably still be nannying.
We wanted to create HH to show that you could have a young man who'd grown up in the exact same apartment line of that building, and that he was a loved, loving person, and that it's really about choices. It's not having this kind of money, living in this kind of environment. It's not a setup. You have choices. And that at every point, the exes seem to be making the wrong ones. So that was the reason for Grandma, and that was our thinking behind creating HH, who we miss still.
And I think that that's very, in our experience, the wrong choices were very symptomatic of the economy spike in the 90s as we were experiencing it. There was definitely a difference between sort of old wealth and newer wealth, and what the norms were for those communities. That Grandma comes from sort of a different experience of the do-nothing model, where there's, you know, that you still are quite involved in experiencing your life. And there was something about the just money falling from the ceiling culture of newer wealth that was, it hadn't quite found its soul yet. It hadn't quite found its footing, at least. And that makes complete sense. You know, it's sort of like any celebrity or anything. You know, when you go from not so much to a ton, there's kind of a transition period. And honestly, we were probably there for many families during that time, as I think Nanny is for the X family.
We'd like to talk a little bit about some of the more wonderful moments that we've had since the book came out, traveling across the country and going to Europe and meeting some of our readers. And the first experience that I think sort of really took us aback was in San Francisco.
Oh. I think that it's amazing to have there's not even a word for what it is to have 28 countries care about something you spend time on. It's bizarre, and I'll try to put words in and none of them will fit. But to have women who have done this work, are doing this work, are beginning to do this work, reach out to us in the manner of which I'll tell you in San Francisco, it just makes your soul full. It's just an incredible thing. There are many words for that. And what happened, with the most poignant of these moments, was a reading we were doing in San Francisco. We had finished reading, and it was quite a packed bookstore, and a young woman stood up in the back, and she had a napping four-year-old sort of wrapped around her, legs akimbo, and she said, "I just want to say to you that I take great pride in what I do. I'm a nanny, and I've never had anything that I can point to and say, this is it, this is what I do, and you've given me that, so thank you."
At which point we both burst into tears.
And then a few other young women stood up and sort of echoed that sentiment. And we took such pride in that work, and it is really a love letter to anyone who works with children or works in a home. You know, the complications. I mean, God, Nikki was saying earlier about, you know, taking the corporate skills or just bringing some kind of resources into families to navigate this. But, I mean, having to give someone their job instructions or receive them while you are wrapped in a towel standing in your own bathroom, you know, sort of holding the door ajar while your child is, you know, running wildly through. I mean, you know, that's complex. That's complex. And you think about, it's just so goofy that as a culture, we've hardly gotten the family thing down completely. That just throwing money into a family or into a marriage and expecting then suddenly these relationships to just work is kind of unrealistic. So.
And then what happened, we got a lot of wonderful letters from across the country and from lots of child care providers. But then a funny thing started happening around June or July of this past summer. The paperback had come out. And I guess last spring, a lot of high school students were asked to pick a book, you know, for free reading. And a lot of them had picked The Nanny Diaries. And suddenly we were hearing from teenagers across the country about sort of what the story had meant to them. And that was not a readership that Emma and I had really anticipated. And it meant a tremendous amount to us. And I'd just like to read a tiny bit from one young man, because I think it was just very charming. My name is Kyle Gleason, and I am 16 years old. I live in northern New Jersey. We were able to choose our own outside reading book for the month of May in English class. I chose to read The Nanny Diaries. For class, we had to do a creative writing piece to sum up our outside reading. We could do all sorts of things, like rewrite the ending, write yourself into the story. I chose to write horoscopes for the characters. Emma, if you won't mind, I'd love to share it. It's just this, he took a lot of time and he did it very well. Sagittarius. Much like a Sagittarius, Mrs. X appears happy and looks well put together on the outside, yet she hides her sadness of a dysfunctional marriage and family when she really needs to open her eyes and look for happiness away from Park Avenue. She needs to realize possessions are not everything, and when it comes down to it, relationships are what really matters. Spending more time with her son in a new atmosphere shall be a revitalizing experience. In the near future, she will realize that changes must be made in her life in order to be truly happy. He characterizes Mr. X as the typical Leo, and tells him to look for happiness in places you least expect. Pisces. Innocence is a virtue, especially in your situation. At such a young age, you are lucky to be unaffected by your parents' relationship and only see the joy in everyone and everything. Yet as you grow older and wiser, the relationship you have with your mother and father will start to affect your actions and decisions. Like the Pisces, you may start to blame yourself for your traumatic childhood, but you must realize at an early age that you do not cause the problems your parents have with each other. It may be hard to realize this on your own, but with help, you will see that you can lead a blissful life. Aries, a caring individual, much like the Aries, you will take risks for others just to help them. However, you must learn not to be taken advantage of and stand up for yourself. Learn to say no!
Exclamation mark.
Your good deeds will be repaid in the long run. Long-term love is in your future. You have found the man of your dreams.
Exclamation mark.
Follow your heart, and all the questions about the relationship will be answered. We love Kyle. We sent him back a very long letter. We think Kyle will go far in life. We also got it was very funny as we were writing the book that we wrote about Prada a lot and L'Occitane, the lavender linen water, which we read in Style last Christmas. Sales of lavender linen water went up 25% after The Nanny Diaries.
And I think if we wanted to bring anything back to our world, it was that women make sure to slow down their ironing with a little bit of lavender water. If you're not doing that with your sheets, you get an F.
So, oddly enough, the head of marketing for L'Occitane happens to be someone I went to high school with, yet not a peep. And Emma comes home last summer to a box, and she's like, ooh, goodies, and opens it up, and there's a letter inside saying, Dear Ms. McLaughlin and Ms. Krause, I am the head of marketing for the Tender Corporation. I was on vacation with my family, and I brought along The Nanny Diaries and was thrilled to see our product, Afterbite, mentioned so kindly in your book, here is a lifetime supply, which is someone who, mosquitoes live for me. So we each got a lifetime supply of Afterbite from the Tender Corporation for dogs, for children, for like every their whole product line. It was the most touching, enchanting. And we apparently the Nanny Diaries has gone in the Tender Corporation library. So that was a delightful, it was God a high bless. Point of the whole experience.
God bless Afterbite and the Tender Corporation. We mention them wherever we go.
Good people.
So we'd like to talk to you a little bit about what's coming next from us. We have been working on a book, as was mentioned, called Citizen Girl. It is coming out, God willing, November 23rd, and it's coming out from a publisher called Atria. And it is very much an extension of what we began to explore with the Nanny Diaries, which we've talked to you about a couple of the different sources of inspiration for that. But another source of inspiration for that, as I talked a little bit in terms of what it is to begin working as a 21-year-old and your expectations and your journey in that, is we really, at its heart, saw the Nanny Diaries, in addition to being an exploration of this community and of the dynamics of childcare as they stand in 2004, was also an exploration of what it is to be and begin to be a working woman. You know, it's interesting, and now on so many tours, that most women have their first experience of working, of really exchanging a professional service for cash as a babysitter. You know, if you think back to that first time you got a dollar or a quarter or $300, most of us, I think it was a small handful of change. It was for a neighbor or a sibling. And so that's kind of the beginning of understanding that role, which is why Nanny Diaries was for us a really fun place to look at an extension of that relationship. So we, in continuing to explore that, our next character's name is Girl. Get the theme there. And it works. You get into it. You buy it. I'm ready to name my first child Girl, actually, if my other child is Nanny, and probably I'll have an HH somewhere in there. It's weird how those things happen, but she's 24 years old and just sort of past the stage that Nanny was at. She's had that first job and is now really beginning her foray into what is for the most part still very much a man's world, into corporate and consulting life in New York City, and especially at this time in the economy in which we're finding it a kind of a strange time to be female, especially to be growing up as female. I'm going to tell that little story about the closet. And here's a snapshot of that. As Nikki mentioned, we're both 30. And I recently had this wonderful opportunity to go and clean out a girlfriend's closet. And I know, does that sound like fun? For people like me and Nikki, it is crazy fun. You know, they have a whole network about this now, about cleaning out closets. And it's very satisfying. By the end of it, you feel you have put your entire house in order and have not gotten off the couch. Either that or you're completely shaking with nerves that you need to put your entire house in order. So it gets, evil or good. But my girlfriend, it was a perfect opportunity because it wasn't one of those closets where you can't even begin to get through. She was very meticulous about how she took care of everything. So everything was hanging, you know, perfectly ironed. It was like a movie. It was like a TV show. She just sort of would trot it out, go in the other room, try it on, and say, keep it or lose it. I sat on the bed. I had cookies. I pointed. She listened. It was great. So we had such a giggle, though, because, you know, lately, as I'm sure you're aware of, pants are getting, like, smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller, and the waistlines are going further and further and further and further down. And the shirts are going tighter and tighter and tighter and going higher and higher and higher up. We frequently find that we're sitting writing together, and I'm like, I'm freezing. Are you freezing? And Nikki says, yeah, but we're completely covered. And then we lean back, and we have this massive gap in our back as our pants are floating down and our shirts are floating up. I mean, come on, you know? And so we're going through my girlfriend's closet with just this problem that if the pants aren't low enough and the shirts aren't high enough, then she just, you know, looks completely outdated. And we're all 30, and we got to look, you know, up to date here in New York City. So she says, But I have this bag full of stuff from college, you know, when I graduated, when I was 21, and I just, you know, this is the outfit I wore when I got off the plane from Italy after my summer abroad, and my mother picked me up, and I was feeling like really feeling like an adult for the first time, and this is the outfit I was wearing when I met my boyfriend, you know, right after graduation. 21 years old, and I think we can all say, you are at your prime, right? Everything is where it should be. This is the moment. Gravity has not set in. So I say, okay, go try it on. Try it on. She comes out hysterical. She is wearing a peasant blouse that she could be 10 months pregnant in. I mean, it is huge, huge, huge. Cut-off jean shorts that were her father's that go down to her knees. Hiking boots that come up, you know, to her upper knees. Big, huge, square, blocky hiking boots. And, you know, when we were 21, this is what we were wearing. Now that we're 30... we're naked, you know? There's something wrong with this. Something very wrong with this. Something is amiss. We feel women are losing all of their power through their lower backs at the moment. So with this experience kind of, it just highlighted for me, these are kind of the themes, in general themes of just what it is right now to be out in a culture where the norms of being female and being naked and being dressed and how you're envisioned and what's acceptable and in the workplace, it's a strange time. So our girl is navigating that, and she will be coming to you on November 23rd.
A few weeks ago, I was having an 80s movie binge. I was watching a lot of John Hughes films, and I called Emma, and I was like, turn on channel whatever. And it was strange to notice that by today's standards, Molly Ringwald, Ione Skye, any of the stars of those films are now would be considered big girls.
Yeah.
And they're just healthy. And it was really shocking to suddenly, I mean, not having seen these films in a long time. And I remember when I was taking care of an 8-year-old in about 98, 97. She's now a gorgeous teenager. And I had to take her shopping one afternoon for new clothes. And she hops into the dressing room. She comes out. And I was like, sweetie, I don't know how to tell you this, but you look like a hooker. Back in the dressing room.
This is not what you wanted to say. This is, you know, you've been the kid with the woman saying you look like a hooker.
But she really did. I mean, it was like there was very little of her covered. And I'm like, you're 8. This just is not appropriate. She's like, but my friends. I was like, I don't care. Your friends can look like Britney Spears, but I want you covered. And it was a very strange time because those were the role models. I said to her one day, I was like, so, you know, what's the new song? What are you into? And she looks up at me with her big eyes and says, hit me, baby, one more time. And I hadn't heard the song yet, but I thought, I don't know exactly what it's about, but I find this problematic. So it's very hard because this girl Arden, and we use her name in the Nanny Diaries, she has come of age in a time when what is being modeled for her is an extraordinary amount of nudity. And are women who, even if they're in arenas, I mean, Britney ostensibly, what her skill set is are her vocal cords. And yet the way she has to market herself is, you know, in I think her latest video, she's in a bathtub. I mean, clothes are gone altogether. Even in films and television, there are very few women that they can point to and admire who are thinking, who are just being valued for what they're thinking. And it's tough for her. She says she just doesn't have a lot to point to. And it's very hard for her to maintain her integrity and for her to say, you know what? Maybe I'm going to put a sweatshirt on over the pasties I'm wearing to the 7th grade dance when she doesn't really have anyone out there in sort of modern culture that she can admire who's doing something similar. So Emma and I are starting to find that very problematic when we walk past newsstands and every actress on the cover of every men's magazine, of which there are now like 100, are all in some, you know, with an arm crossed and a come hither look and wearing tape. It concerns us because we feel that we're on a really bad trajectory.
And just to go a step farther, you know, we're down with the human body and with women's bodies, which are beautiful works of art, and it's not about modesty to our minds. What we're fascinated by, as Nikki, I think, very well put, is we're quite confident that Britney Spears is not sitting in a room by herself deciding that she is going to dress the way she is. You know, that to be able to be more and more, to be able to be successful within our culture, that this is the package you just have to come, you have to ride in with. And we believe that there's a lot of decision makers who are wearing a lot of suits, who are participating and benefiting from those choices. So that, and also that we're at a time, as Nikki said, that in the, you know, I don't think that, and I have in fact heard Britney Spears say personally to me, to Diane Sawyer, that she, wouldn't that be nice? As Madonna used to say, as many, many young women who are celebrities now say, you know, this is, I haven't chosen to be a role model, but it's just that as our culture advances and we don't provide women role models in their academic lives that get attention, role models in their professional lives that get attention, and not only attention, most importantly, they get money. That the women who are making it out there, you know, coincidentally have to be mostly naked to do so. It's kind of happening in a vacuum. So we need more of the other to kind of make it all work. And we could go on and on, but that's our next book. And it's actually funny. So picture everything we just said, only in a big package of funny. So,
But thank you again so much for coming and for wanting to listen to us. And it's just a delight to be here. So thank you so much.
You've been listening to a program from the Utihalee Lecture Series. We've heard a talk by Emma McLaughlin and Nicola Kraus, co-authors of The Nanny Diaries. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Monday morning, May 10th, 2004, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Greg Petler and Randy Figura for their help in the recording of this program. Special thanks also to Tracy Wells and Jody Hobson for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Audio cassette and CD copies are available for $15. Send a check or money order to Utihalee Girls Village, care of Tracy Wells, 3017 Mormon Street, Omaha, Nebraska, 68112-2205. All proceeds from the sale of tapes and CDs will go to benefit the Utihalee Girls Village. Please allow 3 to 4 weeks for delivery. The next lecture in the series will be Monday morning, October 18th at 11 o'clock. The guest speaker will be sportscaster Robin Roberts, co-host of ABC's Good Morning America and ESPN's Sports Center. If you'd like to attend this or other lectures in the series, call the Utihalee Girls Village at 453-0803. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.